Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM President Cary Cranston talks with former chairman and CEO of Playboy Enterprises, Christy Hefner, about the landmark publication and its relation to Ray Bradbury and Fahrenheit 451 in particular. This program took place May 25th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. This is the second of three episodes in a row about Bradbury in the lead-up to his August 22nd birthday. Visit our special exhibit, Ray Bradbury, Inextinguishable, to learn more about the writing legend on display now at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Cary Cranston. I'm the president of the American Writers Museum. And so tonight's program, you know, we're glad you could join us. And I want to first acknowledge that tonight's program is part of our series sponsored by the NEA Big Read program. NEA Big Read is a program of the National Endowment for the Arts and is in partnership with Arts Midwest. Tonight is the latest in a number of programs we're offering in conjunction with the Bradbury exhibit. We're here to talk about one of the most important ways in which Fahrenheit 451 became such a major part of public consciousness, and that was through its serialization in Playboy magazine. Here are the three issues that it appeared in the March, April, and the May issues of 1954. And to talk about that extraordinary moment with us is Christy Hefner, former chairman and CEO of Playboy Enterprises, a business leader, an innovator, activist, philanthropist, and staunch defender of the First Amendment. So please help me in welcoming Christy Hefner.
Thanks very much, Cary, for that warm introduction. It's very nice to be with you, even if it's virtual.
Yes, and it's good to see you again. And so thanks for joining us for this. We're excited to kind of talk through a lot of these different topics. We talked to Sam Weller, the biographer of Ray Bradbury, a while back. And this is actually, it's a part of the exhibit behind me here. We have those original issues. Can you tell me a little bit about how important do you think it was for Playboy in its infancy as a publication? It had only, I think it was the fifth, sixth, and seventh issue to serialize Fahrenheit 451.
I think it was very important. I mean, my father's vision for the magazine was to create this sophisticated new men's lifestyle magazine for his generation of returning veterans from World War II who were looking at their lives and wanting them to be somewhat different than their father's lives had been. And part of that was the idea of kind of a bachelorhood before marriage and family. And so having a positioning that was upscale was really essential. And that meant that quality was really important, whether that was the ads or the illustration and certainly the writing. But I also think it was important because I think that, you know, my dad very much understood that he was going to be challenging conventions in the magazine and breaking taboos. So I think the subject matter of Fahrenheit 451 and its challenge to orthodoxy and to censorship, I have to believe, had a special appeal to him.
Yeah. And do you know anything specific about why your father decided to do this at an early time in the publication?
What I know is, not surprisingly, because he was not a company, he was a person, the magazine started with limited capital. And in fact, he would share later that he had mortgaged our furniture twice to have enough money to put out the first issue and had deliberately not put the month of December on the cover because he knew from his years at Esquire that the way the magazine newsstand business worked is that once you were at the end of the month on the cover, whatever hadn't been sold, the newsstand dealers returned back for money. And his theory was if they didn't know it was the end of its on sale period, he might get a little extra on sale period, which would give him a little extra money to be able to print the second issue. So, in fact, the first issue featured in its fiction a public domain short story by Arthur Conan Doyle, because, of course, there were no rights to be paid. And that was how they got started. But he had read the paperback edition of Fahrenheit 451, which is all that had been published up to that point. And I think it was published in October, so very shortly before Playboy magazine started. And he would say that he was a big fan of the work. And so he thought, this is a chance to kind of put a big stake in the ground in terms of bringing to our audience this important and powerful work. And so he wrote to Ray, and I think the story goes, he offered him $400 to serialize it in three separate issues. And Ray said yes. And it's interesting because subsequently there would be a hardcover deal for Fahrenheit, which who knows, but may have been helped along by its visibility in the magazine. But I know for sure that Hef felt that it was the kind of fiction that was both of its time and timeless.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think, you know, what impact do you think publishing that particular work, you know, and serializing something like that, that was so new, had on the magazine at the time, and then also over the years?
I think, especially in hindsight, it's really interesting that both Fahrenheit itself as a work of fiction and Playboy were both in that early 50s period, because we tend to think of the 50s as the Eisenhower years, as a period of great conformity from the banal man in the gray flannel suit, happy housewife, to the scary, you know, McCarthy era. And I might add that Ray was one of the very few writers in the Screenwriters Guild who vehemently objected to the loyalty oaths that were being imposed. But the reality is, with the benefit of historical perspective, that a lot of the seeds of ferment and change that sort of blossomed late in the 50s and the early 60s were really planted in the early to mid 50s. So you have the sexual revolution, the Kinsey report is coming out. You have the early stirrings of the women's movement, of the civil rights movement. You have that kind of rebelliousness in the arts, whether it was, you know, what Ray was writing, or whether it was Jack Kerouac, Miles Davis, who incidentally was the very first Playboy interview done by Alex Haley. You have things like, you know, Jackson Pollock and that kind of art movement. So there's this interesting kind of tension, I think, in the 50s that made it a time of ferment that created the opportunity for rebels. And I think that that made it the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good synopsis of those conflicting things that were happening at that point. And I think also, as you said, people may not think of Ray Bradbury as radical. And yet at the time that story and that book were fairly radical.
Very much so. And I think Ray was proud of the fact that it was a banned book.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea that you would write a book about book burning and censorship and have it get banned.
I know. It's too ironic, right?
Yes. And, you know, I you're someone, you know, who ran the publication of Playboy and the enterprises and everything behind it. So you've faced issues of censorship, which is obviously that theme of the book, the idea of being able to cancel thoughts and ideas. How important do you find Fahrenheit 451 to be today? Do you think it's something that should still be taught as it is in schools? Is it out of date? What do you feel about it as a work now?
I think it stands the test of time. I think it is both relevant and resonant. And I know Ray was a big fan of myths. Mm-hmm. And I think of Fahrenheit 451 as a kind of a timeless modern myth that has not been made irrelevant with the passage of now 70 years. Because if you really take a step back from today, and of course, the American Writers Museum grapples with this all the time too, so it's really relevant that we're having this conversation, that the same instinct to censor, or to use the vernacular today, to cancel, that was at the heart of the dynamic that Ray was writing about in the early 50s, is there in a big way in contemporary society, as is, I would argue, a kind of anti-intellectualism that also was a part of what Ray was attacking. And I think that the book in talking about as its theme, you know, freedom and oppression and democracy, I think it just reminds us that it's a kind of a call to action, that we can't afford to be complacent. You know, Ray once said that he felt that he was Montag, who is the kind of hero of the book, who begins the book as a fireman, who, for those who haven't read the book or haven't read it in a while, as the society has devolved as opposed to evolved, the firemen are now charged with actually finding and burning books. And the whole principle there is that the society and the powers that be feel that books are too dangerous because they cause unhappiness. They raise questions that can't be answered. They provoke conflict, and that the society and its citizens needs to be protected from those things. And I think that there is a similar dynamic that is going on, whether it's around safe spaces on college campuses or in the debate, you know, in what it gets published today. So I just feel that it's maybe more timely even than ever before. And I loved the one of the comments that Ray once said about Fahrenheit 451. He said, I wasn't trying to predict the future. I was trying to prevent it.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I think you bring up a really good point in the sense that we tend to focus on this book and its notion of censorship. Mm-hmm. But there's a notion to censorship that is well thought out. In other words, people are carefully trying to take things away from people. But you also brought up the anti-intellectualism of it and that notion of not wanting to, you know, to recognize the work that people do, that is intellectual, that is analysis, that is science. And that's very much a big part of the book. It's not just the idea of censorship. It's also just being against the idea of thought in general.
Yeah. And, you know, think of how in our own society, in some quarters, the word elite has become, you know, a kind of a sign of disrespect, where it used to be a sign of respect.
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious, you know, over the years, Ray did other interviews with Playboy and was involved. You know, what kind of relationship did your father have with Ray, and what kind of relationship did Ray have with Playboy itself?
Yeah, they were friends. And I think that there were certain things that bonded them and bound them. One was unquestionably the deep sort of anathema they both felt towards censorship and the deep commitment in favor of freedom of expression. And I think that was something that, you know, was clearly shared. But I also think that they enjoyed each other as kind of creative people. I do think both of them were visionaries, and that it reflected itself in different ways. But certainly, you know, I think arguably my father was a visionary in terms of what he created with Playboy, but Ray was a super visionary too, and had this sort of expansive sense of what interested him. You know, he would talk about going to the Chicago World Fair when he was 12 and just being fascinated by these sort of little glimpses of what the future might be, and became a huge fan of everything from magic to architecture. And I actually got to know him in my years working at the company. And he was just this polymath. I mean, he just had this breadth and depth of curiosity and interest. And I think that was kind of a part of what bound them together. They were both highly opinionated, for sure, and sure of their opinions. And I know Ray had a sign, I don't know if it's part of the exhibit, over his typewriter that said, "Don't think." Because he had this very strong belief that writers needed to write from a place of feeling and not overthink. And actually was pretty harsh in his belief that writers shouldn't go to school to learn to write. He wasn't anti-intellectual, but that writing had to be from your life experiences. I saw a wonderful interview that was done when Ray was quite ill already. So this was back in 2010 when the Writers Guild in LA brought my dad and Ray together for a little kind of interview. And I think it was the first time that they had been together for a few years because Ray had not been in very good health. And it gave my dad a chance to say that he was both honored and proud to have published Fahrenheit 451. But he also shared something that I hadn't known before that, that he wanted to publicly thank Ray for, which was not for the writing that Ray himself had done, but that there was another writer, Charles Beaumont, who happened to also be a Chicagoan, who Ray had mentored and brought to the magazine, to Playboy, and said, this is a really gifted young writer, and you know, you ought to take a look at him before he'd really become well known. Mm-hmm. And again, back in 54 or 55, Playboy published an original short story of his called Black Country, and then published a piece that became a really important piece in the history of the magazine and, as we're discussing, its willingness to take on controversial issues. And it was called The Crooked Man. And the premise of the piece was a future in which what you think is happening is it's kind of a pre-Stonewall period where people who are homosexual have to be in hiding and meet secretly. And only at the end of the story is the twist revealed, which is that on this planet, in this world, at this time, it's the reverse. And heterosexuality is the stigmatized, crooked, minority form of sexuality. And this was 1955, which was a pretty astonishing time to have published something like that. And so at that occasion, have had the chance to say to Ray, thank you for bringing Charles Beaumont to us, who would go on, I might add, to write some of the most memorable and impactful episodes of Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think that connection between, you know, Playboy and fiction in general, you know, I mean, it was so important to the magazine, and I'm curious, you know, your thoughts about how it defined the magazine and how you think it might have made the magazine special.
Well, certainly as a former English major, I was greatly appreciative of the fact that pretty much Playboy and The New Yorker were the two magazines that were publishing not just excerpts of novels, but original short fiction, and provided platforms for younger writers, as we were just discussing in the context of Beaumont, but also a way of reaching a larger audience than, say, a collection or an anthology of short fiction might reach. It was the only category that Playboy magazine was ever nominated for a National Magazine Award was in fiction. So that was kind of exciting. And when you go back and look at the list of fiction writers that appeared in the magazine, I mean, it's an overused expression, but it truly is a who's who. I mean, it's everybody from, you know, Margaret Atwood and Joyce Carol Oates and John Updike and John Irving and Nadine Gordimer and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Gore Vidal. And I mean, just everybody. And it in part was because here was a magazine that was reaching millions and millions of readers, but not dumbing down what the content, either the nonfiction or the fiction was.
Yeah. And I mean, how fast did Playboy take off then? You know, it became so gigantic. And of course, you know, when he there, as you said, he was mortgaging the furniture to get it off the ground. But how quickly did that growth happen?
Pretty quickly. We did not have our furniture repossessed, so that was a early good sign. I do not remember having to sleep in a drawer and a, you know, dresser in the bedroom. But yeah, it was, I won't remember the exact date, but it surpassed Esquire in its first decade, which was, you know, kind of the inspiration of, you know, sophisticated men's magazine. And I think it was that classic, the right idea at the right time executed brilliantly. That is what is the magic mix.
Yeah. And you mentioned Esquire and your father worked at Esquire and it was sort of that magazine. What What was it that took him from Esquire to want to launch his own? What was the driving?
Two things. One, maybe a little mundane, and one more philosophical. The mundane was that Esquire had some of its offices at the time my dad worked for them in Chicago. And he was actually not on the editorial side. He was working on promotional copy for them. And a decision got made that they were going to move all of their offices to New York. And they only offered certain people jobs in New York, but they did offer my dad a job in New York. So that was kind of a cool thing. But he really loved Chicago, and he really didn't think he would like New York that much. And the way sometimes you think in life, you want a sign. So he went back to his manager and he asked for a $5 a week raise to go to New York with his then baby me and his wife. And the manager said, you know, Mr. Hepner, we're not even extending, you know, job offers to all of our employees, and you should be grateful that you're getting it. And no, we're not giving you a $5 a week raise. And Hef saw it as a sign that he should stay. And I should say that years later, at the 25th anniversary of the magazine, I put the promotional plan together that led to the start of the First Amendment Awards and some other things. But we also did a roast at Tavern on the Green to create a journalism scholarship in my dad's name at the University of Illinois. And Clay Felker was the then editor of Esquire. And he got up and told that story and then said, we've been watching you, Hep, and we think that we're prepared to offer you a job back with back pay, and pulled out this huge $5 bill. So that was the sort of mundane piece. And I think the philosophical piece was that my dad felt that some of the smart sexiness of Esquire, the cartoons and the petty girls and the willingness to understand that there was a sexual revolution going on, had they'd retreated from that and had become more cautious, more conservative, and that created a space.
Okay. Very interesting. I'm kind of curious, you know, when we're talking about Bradbury and we're talking about some of these issues, and you brought it up a little bit, but, you know, in our modern information-driven world with the web and social media, you know, I'd asked before if, you know, if the book is dated, and do you think that the notion of book burning carries any weight when our world is so digital?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think that it does, because I think it's such a powerful metaphor that it kind of transcends what the form of the distribution of the content is. And I know Ray would talk about how, you know, he was coming of age at a time when, you know, radio was dominant, then television was becoming, you know, the form of, you know, kind of mass communication, and that worried him in terms of, would that have an impact on people reading less? He worried about whether that would impact on libraries, which, as you know, he loved passionately. Although I would add that when you think about the early 1950s, when he wrote Fahrenheit, those images of those huge flat screen TVs that are so dominant in the book, wow, talk about having sort of a prescient vision for the world we now live in 70 years later. I know that was pretty cool. But he was, I think, worried about whether different forms would not just impact the power of the idea of book burning, but even more fundamentally, the power of reading and how we take in information. And, you know, certainly he lived long enough to see the internet and maybe not as much the power of social media, but the internet. And I know before he died, he talked about that, and that he understood in the positive way the kind of global connectivity that the web represented, and could see the positive in that. But I know, you know, he worried a lot that it would change how people read, who they read, and how much they had a sense of kind of yesterday. And I think those are concerns that we are grappling with today.
Yeah. And you brought up the notion of this is, you know, the metaphor of book burning, not the literal nature of it. And, you know, the book is an allegory in sort. So I guess my question is, you know, what do you see as the biggest threats then today to free speech? You know, I think you touched on it a little bit, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, because obviously this is an area where you worked in for so long.
Right. Well, I alluded to what's happening on campuses, and I do worry about the tendency to want to disinvite speakers whose points of view are at odds with the majority of the campus, or to try and excise from reading lists books of different points of view. And indeed, even though we live in a very digital world, the American Library Association's Freedom to Read Foundation, which is based here in Chicago and with whom I've worked closely, particularly in conjunction with the First Amendment Awards, mm-hmm. would tell you that there is no diminution in efforts to censor books in libraries and in schools today. That is still a real and ongoing challenge, and it comes from both sides of the political spectrum. So you can have the efforts to censor the kinds of books that deal with marginalized communities, whether it's LGBTQ communities or other minority communities, from one side of the spectrum, but you can also have from the other side the inclination to censor books that are dealing with, say, racism, but include racist language. And so the need to kind of push back on that and to just continue to reinforce the idea that the whole idea of books and of reading is to reach across boundaries, to show us both what we have in common, but also to open us up to worlds that are different than the worlds that we're familiar with. And sometimes that means challenging us, and that is something that we should treasure, because we need to understand our differences and our similarities. And I think that only by doing that are we actually going to create a society that is respectful and pluralistic, which is at its heart what our democracy is founded on. And I also think that willingness to be challenged, and we talked about it earlier in the context of what's in Fahrenheit 451, which is the government's feeling that people have to be protected from ideas that might challenge them or make them uncomfortable or offend them. And yeah. that we have to push back against that now, just as much as Ray was pushing back against that in the 50s.
Yeah. And you've mentioned offhand a couple of times the Hugh Hefner First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about those awards? You created them, you know, what are they? Why are they so important? You know, tell us about them.
Well, they are near and dear to my heart. So during the 25th anniversary, so this was 1979, we were looking for kind of special ways to celebrate the anniversary. And as I mentioned, we launched this journalism scholarship. We toured the art collection. But we also decided, after many years of the magazine writing about issues of freedom of expression and the foundation funding the American Civil Liberties Union and the Freedom to Read Foundation and other organizations, that maybe there was a way to elevate the work of individuals that were in the trenches, in the moment, standing up for freedom of expression, whether they were librarians or a yearbook editor or a whistleblower. And so we launched the awards with the idea that every year there would be independent judges drawn from people who themselves were real warriors on behalf of the First Amendment. And then they would make the selection of honorees, and they would be in categories that would range from law and government to book publishing and journalism. And when I left running Playboy, we sort of picked that up and do it through the Hugh M. Hefner Foundation that my father had put in place during his lifetime. And it's kind of a labor of love. And I consider the people who've both been judges and who have been honored kind of the best fraternity sorority you can be a part of.
And are there particular honorees that stick in your head? Either from recent years or past. I've gone through some of the lists. I think there's some pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'd be hard pressed to, you know, you hate to pick out any ones, but since we're talking about books, I'll name two books that were honored. One is by another Chicagoan, the constitutional scholar Jeffrey Stone, who wrote a fantastic book called Free Speech in Perilous Times, which really takes on the kind of the history of the tension that has existed between our avowed support for the idea of freedom of expression with our inclination at various times to say, well, I'm not for censorship, but, and it's just, and he's also a gifted writer, which is not always true of scholars. And then a more recent one, which was just an eye opener for me, was called Rap on Trial. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm not a fan of rap music. It's not my favorite kind of music. I really had been unaware of the literal criminalization of the lyrics by prosecutors seeking to convict usually young men of color of violent crimes. So literally using as testimony in criminal cases, artistic expression that these musicians had created. So those are two that just come to mind.
Well, and I think it's important that those awards are there and that people can look at them, you know, if they visit the website. You know, I think that, you know, as you said, there are a lot of books that are listed there because there are a lot of people who've been awarded. And then there are just really interesting people that folks should know about if this is something that concerns them.
Absolutely. Go to the Hugh M. Hefner Foundation website and you would be very happy if you just took a look at all of the previous, just even book winners, and you'd have a terrific reading list.
and I assume if started this in 53, 54, that Ray might have been honored by the foundation.
I would, it's interesting, you know, we've never, in the book side, it's never been a work of fiction, but I can't imagine that Fahrenheit wouldn't have risen to the top.
And you know, as someone who's such a staunch supporter of the freedom of speech, I'm curious, you know, you've mentioned a couple of writers, but are there any other writers besides Bradbury that you found important to read?
This is actually, I realize now, one of our awards. There's, a super important book called The Coddling of the American Mind. Mm-hmm. One of the authors was the founder of FIRE, which is an organization that works for freedom of expression on campuses, Greg Lukianoff. That is a really important book to help all of us understand why is this battle going on today? Why are there these instincts to, you know, kind of censor, and what does it mean? So that's one for sure. And then just generally, I guess, about books, I'm pretty eclectic in my book reading interests between fiction and nonfiction and history and biography. But I always am especially touched by books that open up a window to a world that is not a world that I really understood as well as I did after the end of the book. So I found books like The Nickel Boys, mm-hmm. or Homeland Elegies, or I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, really impactful.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the beauty of the books and the things that we celebrate here is that capacity for people to reach and teach.
Yeah.
It's an amazing part of this. So you met Ray, you talked about meeting Ray. I'm curious, beyond Fahrenheit 451, are there works of Ray's or anything about Ray that you really enjoyed of him as a writer?
I was very affected by The Illustrated Man, which also happened to run in Playboy. I just, you know, that's a great example for me of something that Ray believed that I might not have understood when I was growing up, but I came to understand as an adult, which is that for the best writers, for people like Ray and say Arthur C. Clarke and others like that, science fiction is not a genre. And it certainly is not a genre that is a lesser genre as it sometimes was thought of. Mm-hmm. It's a way of thinking about the world. And it's a way of unleashing your imagination that should be sort of aspirational for all of us. One of my favorite Ray comments was that imagination is not just the ability to fantasize, it's the ability to survive and the ability to grow. And I always felt that the imagination that Ray brought to his unbelievably prolific life, as you know very well, across many types of writing, screenwriting and short stories and obviously novels, teleplays, that he was sort of the embodiment of that.
Well, that I think that's a really great look at who he is. And I think it's really interesting how, you know, he intersected so perfectly with the foundation of the magazine and where they overlapped. Thank you, Christy, for joining us and for having this conversation.
My pleasure. And everybody go to the American Writers Museum.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we chat with Charles Ardai, editor of the short story anthology Killer, Come Back to Me, The Crime Stories of Ray Bradbury. Visit our special exhibit, Ray Bradbury, Inextinguishable, to learn more about the writing legend, on display now at the American Writers Museum. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.